and welcome to Sports Illustrated on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first article is the cover article for April 2026. Dynamic Duo by Tom Verducci. The 2026 season begins with baseball being more popular than it has been in years, thanks to sluggers Shohei Ohtani and Aaron Judge. The trick for MLB now is to keep the momentum going. Never mind Yalta. As summit meetings of superpowers go, non-geopolitical division, precedent for the one at New York Hotel Ballroom in January, could be found in French Lick, Indiana. There in the summer of 1985, Boston Celtics great Larry Bird, the two-time reigning NBA MVP, hosted Los Angeles Lakers great Magic Johnson at his mother's house to shoot a Converse sneakers ad known as Choose Your Weapon. Though Bird and Magic had competed against one another since the 1979 NCAA championship, the rivals kept such distance between them that they had not even casually shaken hands, no less sat down at Georgia Bird's kitchen table, as they did for a home-cooked meal that afternoon. Bound as rivals and friends, Bird and Magic changed the trajectory of the NBA as an entry. They sold shoes, sure. They also sold the sport. The average NBA salary in the 1980s rose from $180,000 to $900,000. Bird or Magic, and three times both, played in every NBA Finals of the decade. They won six MVP awards in a seven-year stretch, interrupted only by the newly ascendant Michael Jordan. 41 years later, the two greatest superpowers in baseball, Aaron Judge of the Yankees and Shohei Ohtani of the Dodgers, greeted one another for their first formal photo shoot together. No commercial was involved, but Judge and Ohtani, like Bird and Magic, chose the same brand of weapon. In this case, their bats, not their shoes. After the 2022 season, prompted by watching, Judge hit his American League record 62 home runs, Ohtani, through his agent, Nez Bolello, contacted Chandler Bats, the maker of Judge's bat. Chuck Shupp, a Chandler rep, immediately began crafting a bat for Ohtani. Since then, Ohtani has hit the most home runs in baseball, 153, with Judge right behind him at 148. Like Bird and Magic, one on the East Coast, one on the West, gobbling up MVPs, playing a sui generis style thanks to their size and strength. Judge and Ohtani are the standard bearers, helping to carry their sport to heights not seen in a generation. Baseball attendance has increased three straight years for the first time since 2005-2007. The World Series, in which Ohtani won his second straight championship since joining the Dodgers, averaged 34 million viewers in the United States, Canada, and Japan, the biggest World Series audience since 1992. Game 7 attracted 51 million viewers in the U.S., Canada, and Japan, the most watched game since Game 7 of the 91 World Series. Thanks to the pitch clock, the average time of game has been no more than 2 hours, 40 minutes for three straight years, for the first time since 83-85. The 2026 season rides the wings of this renaissance, but under the threat of a gathering storm, a labor war. Owners are likely to impose a lockout of the players when the collective bargaining agreement expires December 1st, as happened in 2021. That lockout ended after 99 days, just in time to preserve what is now a record 31-season streak without a game being lost to labor strife since the MLBPA was officially recognized in 1966. An end to that streak would curb the game's momentum, not to mention stealing from the primes of Judge, who turns 34 in April, and Ohtani, who turns 32 in July. From Babe Ruth and Rogers Hornsby to Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio to Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle to Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, baseball eras have been speckled with tandems of hitting contemporaries that dominate the game and generate national interest. But never like this. Judge and Ohtani have together won 7 MVP awards in the last 5 years, 5 of them unanimously. Over the past 2 seasons, they have secured 107 of the 120 first-place MVP votes, or 89%. This year, both have the opportunity for a never-been-done third straight 50-homer season. Over the past 5 seasons, they rank 1-2 in the majors in home runs, slugging, and OPS, Judge leads, and WAR, and total bases, Ohtani leads. Even dressed in formal wear, as they were for the cover of this shoot, Judge and Ohtani present an outsized physical bearing that adds Marvel style to their superpower status. The 6'9 Bird was a tall, sharp shooter without precedent, just as 6'9 Johnson revolutionized the point. At 6'7, 282 pounds, Judge is not only the biggest of the 4 players to hit 50 homers 4 times, Ruth, McGwire, and Sosa are the others, but also the biggest player to win a batting title and to hit as high as .331, which he did last year. "How is that possible?" says Yankees manager Aaron Boone. "I asked him that question in the offseason. He was in the training room, and I said this a lot last year. I never felt that he was totally locked in or on fire like he was during times in 22, 23, and 24. And yet he's hitting .331 with 50-something homers and an OPS 100 points higher than anybody else." What he said was the one thing he always does is he goes home in the winter and works on different little things. Guys always say, "I want to keep getting better." He takes it to heart. When he sets his mind to something, look out. And I think last year he figured out how to get his hits when he was not at his best. Pitches he might swing over and miss, he found a way to still have a competitive swing and still have power. So efficient was Judge last season that in 679 plate appearances, he grounded out to an infielder on the right side only twice, the same number of times he popped out to the pool side. He devours fastballs. Last year, he hit .410 against them and slugged an absurd .874. He even improved his sprint speed to his best since 2022. That Judge is still peaking at this age is all thanks to 2 tweaks he made in 2022, refining his swing to generate more balls in the air and adjusting his work and recovery to avoid soft tissue injuries. His 4 highest fly ball rates have all come since then, a huge advantage for someone who last year saw more than 1 out of every 3 of his fly balls leave the yard, 51 of 149. He has played 150 games 3 times in his 30s, winning the MVP each time, after doing so once in his 20s. "He is conscientious about how he ages," Boone says. "He's really self-aware. That's the biggest thing in the last several years he's mastered. He was very ticked off when he had injuries that cost him time. He's become very good at understanding what he needs to do to go to the post every day. He's learned how to back off once he gets into his season. Playing through minor stuff, he's really good at it. The little nagging injuries that come up, soft tissue-wise, he knows how to govern them." Ohtani, too, is a physical outlier. There has never been a player this tall, 6'3", and this heavy, 210 pounds, a conservative listing, who has stolen 50 bases, as Ohtani did in 24, in his unprecedented 50-50 season. No one should ever stop marveling at how he is elite at 2 distinct disciplines, pitching and hitting, like juggling chainsaws on a unicycle. In the pennant-clinching game last fall, he struck out 3 Brewers in the top of the first, switched to his hitting gear, Superman style, without having enough time to go into the dugout. Then he hit the first leadoff postseason homer as a pitcher. He hit two more homers, including one that flew out of Dodger Stadium, and struck out 10 in what has to be the most amazing playoff game ever. Also under consideration would be World Series Game 3, in which he became the first player to reach base 9 times in a postseason game, including a record 4 intentional walks. He capped his season, which began with rehabbing a twice-repaired elbow ligament, of 175 games and 809 plate appearances, fifth most ever, by starting Game 7 on short rest, then proceeded to join Jeff Tesro of the 1912 New York Giants as the only World Series Game 7 starting pitchers to reach base 3 times. Even though he didn't pitch at all in 2024 and made only 14 mound appearances last regular season, Ohtani is an unprecedented two-way player. Ruth made only 34 starts on the mound as a full-fledged two-way player, after which he said, "I don't think a man can pitch in his regular turn and play every other game at some other position and keep that pace year after year." Ohtani has made 100 mound starts as a two-way player. The Dodgers expect him to make between 23 and 28 this year, as he did for 3 seasons, 21 through 23, with the Angels. We are of the mind that this is a long-term play, obviously with his contract and doing the two-way, said Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. So if that's the case, then what does that look like? I think that the number one thing is you're talking about pitching. I don't think the plate appearances are going to change. Pitching, he came into camp as a regular, healthy player, preparing for a season, not in rehab mode. I think that the 6, 7, and 8 days in between starts is totally feasible. And then it goes to each game managing him within the game. Are there going to be times that I push him? Sure. But I would say for the most part, I'm still taking a long view. Look at the pitching this season and beyond. This is sustainable because of who he is, how well he knows himself, and how well he trusts us in the sense of how we're going to manage him. Bird was a trash talker. Magic was the stage-ready magician who ran the Showtime Lakers. Judge and Ohtani do it differently. They hold up the game as Atlas did the heavens, pure strength under enduring, quiet responsibility. He understands his standing in the game, Boone says of Judge. But it all starts with him being a great Yankee. It means so much to him being a captain, the way he makes his teammates feel. When we gather for the first full squad workout, he will make the lowest man of the 65 or 70 feel a part of it. He's amazing at that. Says Roberts of Ohtani, "Our guys understand how good he is and what he means for the Dodgers. They realize he's a great person and a great teammate, whose world is different from everybody else's. He wants to be the best player in the world, and above all, he wants to win." Over the past 2 seasons, pitcher Ryan Yarbrough has been a teammate of both Ohtani and Judge. He has pitched against them with little success, allowing .308 average to Ohtani and .381 to Judge, while marveling at how they've done it. "I'm thinking, cool, if I just keep it down and away, they may get their hits, but not with damage. That's not the case with either one. They both have the ability to elevate the ball with power, no matter the location." More impressive, Yarbrough says, is how they carry themselves as teammates. He sees in each one a zen-like quality to remain calm amid the tension of the game or the noise around their celebrity status as standard bearers. "They seem larger than life," Yarbrough says, "and yet it's really easy for them to just be one of the guys. Judge and Ohtani. Ohtani and Judge. Their greatness separates them from all of their contemporaries except from one another, like a rare conjunction of celestial bodies deep in Atlas's heavens. Only 7 players have posted back-to-back 50 homer seasons. Judge and Ohtani are the first pair to do so together with at least 7 WAR in both years. It is baseball kismet that their peaks should align like this and raise the game by the power of 2. You're listening to Sports Illustrated on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next article, what's the boss? Where have you gone, Billy Martin? The job of an MLB manager is no longer the domain of gruff former players, unless they're also the perfect combination of a stat head, amateur psychiatrist, media expert, TikTok adopter, motivational guru, etc. By Stephanie Epstein. The sound of the wood bat still turns Tony Vitello's head. The new manager of the Giants is trying to figure out where the bathrooms are and what the rules are and who the players are. But he is also trying to get used to the most visceral change of all, crack instead of ping. After 24 years coaching at the collegiate level, Vitello admits he will miss the metal bats a bit. But this is so natural, he says. It's a tradition-based sport. That's part of the tradition. In some ways, Vitello is, too. Sure, he's an unconventional choice, the first person to go straight from the college ranks to major league manager. But these days, a brief resume is more common than a lifetime of riding the buses and filling out lineup cards in the minors. Of the 8 managers hired since the end of 2025 regular season, only 3 had done the job before. Only 2 of the remaining 5 had ever led a team in pro ball. Neither Craig Stammen, Padres, nor Kurt Suzuki, Angels, had ever even so much as coached before. All these men will try to tackle a job whose description seems to grow longer every day. The modern manager must navigate a clubhouse and the stars and scrubs therein. Keep track not just of whose arm hurts, but also of who is arguing with his wife. Absorb and process information from quants and scouts alike. Disseminate that information to people who want varying degrees of it. Solicit opinions and then massage the egos of those who advice he did not take. Address the media at least 2x per day. Take public responsibility for decisions he did not make. And represent a multi-billion dollar corporation on the global stage while dressed in baseball pants. Oh, and he has to decide whether to pull the starter in the 3rd inning. 7 to 10 p.m., says Atlanta general manager Alex Anthopoulos, feels like the smallest part of the job. The manager might be the most important job in the organization, and we're still not entirely sure what makes someone good at it. Every so often, Tigers manager A.J. Hinch hears from an old Astros co-worker who wants to reminisce about a play he called in the 2nd inning of Game 7 of the 2017 World Series with one out and one of the slowest runners in the sport, catcher Brian McCann, on third base. Houston pitcher Lance McCullers Jr., who bats left-handed, grounded to second. McCann, who is going on contact, scored to extend the lead the team would not relinquish. It was the most valuable such groundout in baseball history, and it was Hinch, then the Astros skipper, who told McCann to go. It's one thing for a manager to call the contact play in July with a guy who runs like an umpire. It's another thing entirely to do it in Game 7 of the World Series. What I learned about moves that are made in the World Series is that you have to make those moves long in advance, says Hinch, meaning you have to be in front of that decision by how you prepare your players and how you set the foundation of how you're going to play and the why behind it. You are always preparing for future decisions by the decisions you make today. Rangers GM Chris Young estimates in-game decision-making constitutes 10 to 15% of a manager's job. That figure might be on the decline as new rules, the universal designated hitter, the ghost runner on second base in extra innings, the limit on mound disengagements, reduce the number of choices at any moment. In a lot of ways, it's more checkers than it is chess, says White Sox assistant GM Josh Barfield. It's taken out some of the strategy. So much of that strategizing takes place long before the game begins. I don't know how many managers just make their own decisions, says Royals skipper Matt Quartaro. He's not even just referring to the front office. There are so many people involved these days. The research department, the trainers, the mental skills staffers, the bench coach, the pitching coach, the hitting coach. And sometimes he takes all of that information and still chooses not to field the best team possible because sometimes he wants to give perennial MVP candidate shortstop Bobby Witt Jr. a day off. A lot of the philosophies are good until you have to actually apply them, Quartaro says, and you have to force yourself to focus on process over result. I think when you're a younger manager, you have a hard time accepting that you could make the right decision and have the wrong outcome, says the 51-year-old Hinch. The tactical moves are the only part of the manager's job that the fans see. Managers often joke, "If I don't matter, why do you keep yelling at me?" But before they can pinch hit in the ninth inning, they have to have received scouting reports from the advanced guy on the pitcher they'll face, as well as the tendency and pitch shape and swing plane data from the quants. They have to have laid the groundwork with both the pinch hitter and the guy he's replacing. Both need to prepare for their roles, and both need time to tend to their feelings about the situation. In some ways, that's just the same as it ever was. "We're still chasing matchups," says Hinch. "We've always chased matchups. We're just willing to do that a little more aggressively today than we were." He adds, "All the things that may drive the traditional fan crazy, it's actually just emphasizing the strengths of the players." But in other ways, the decision-making process would be completely unrecognizable to a manager from 30 years ago. Red skipper Terry Francona says that when he started with the Phillies before the 1997 season, there was a general manager and the assistant general manager, and that was about it. These days, teams often employ 50 analysts. It can be a little overwhelming, he says. Still, he adds, in today's world of analytics and numbers, I feel an obligation to the organization and to the team not to guess. Does that mean I'm going to make every decision right? No, but I'm going to have a reason. When you forget you're dealing with people, I think you're making a big mistake. Once in a while, someone wanting to talk to Guardians manager Stephen Vogt has to wait a minute outside his office. Vogt is busy crying in the bathroom. It's important, he says, to understand that what might be a minor transaction in your eyes is a huge moment for that player. Being able to have empathy with the most no-brainer option or the most no-brainer DFA or whatever it might be, that's the worst day of that person's life. So he tries to sit down with every player who is getting bad news. And sometimes he becomes so upset on the young man's behalf that even after the kid has left and tossed his glove into a duffel bag, the manager is still recovering from the conversation. I think you create a good atmosphere and a good environment, a learning environment, a commitment, a team atmosphere that leads to success, the second-year Rockies manager Warren Schaefer said. That is my main job because I spend most of the day doing it. Running the game, that's 3 hours. I spend 12 hours on culture. Perhaps Vitello's time surrounded by teenagers will help him relate to young major leaguers. The former Tennessee coach who led the Volunteers to a College World Series title in 2024 is used to the Gen Z attention span. They've been on TikTok, says the 47-year-old. They've got about 20 seconds, and he is ready with strategies to keep his players engaged. Show some videos, he says. Sometimes cracking jokes works. Such answers can sometimes veer into cliche, but this cohort does require different methods of connection. Young people today communicate through their phones more often than face-to-face, so a manager has to be adept at both channels, and he has to account for the anxiety that a digital childhood can foster. Today's players has to understand why, says Guardians GM Mike Chernoff, 44, and you have to provide evidence. The traditional, because I said so, doesn't fly. Today's player is also at least as familiar with most data as his coaches, and his coach better be as fluent in that language as he is. This is how they've grown up in the game, says Rockies president of baseball operations, Paul De Podesta. This is an expectation. Most people shy away from the idea that managing is increasingly a young man's job, perhaps because they hope one day to be old men in that job. What I think is happening is general managers are becoming younger, says Francona, and they're looking for people they're comfortable with. But the 41-year-old Vogt, who spent 10 seasons in the majors as a catcher, acknowledges that he was caught off guard by the physical toll. It's a long season, even if you're not playing in it. So he does an Orange Theory fitness class every morning. I want to make sure my heart's healthy, he says. I want to make sure I don't get too sloppy. Young managers do have an advantage when it comes to relatability. The players look at you differently when there's a wider age gap or different experience, or when you've accomplished something in the game, or as you become more notable, Hinch says. His solution is to allow yourself to be vulnerable. I really want them to understand that I make mistakes too, and I know how hard the game is. The job gets harder as you become more notable too. I have to fight harder to stay connected to the thing that matters most, which is the relationship with the players, says Dodger manager Dave Roberts. The irony is the thing I got into this because I love, which is coaching, is the thing that you do the least as you continue to climb the ladder. That's basically true for the Dodgers, who with their three Japanese stars have to answer as much to fans in Tokyo as in Los Angeles. But each team in each market brings its own difficulties. I'm not sure all 30 of us have the same job, Hinch says. This has always been the case. Philly's president of baseball operations, Dame Dombrowski, remembers being a young administrative assistant with the 1978 White Sox, a year after they made a surprise run at the pennant with a veteran team. That winter, they let several older free agents walk, and halfway through the 78 season, fired their 57-year-old manager, Bob Lemon, who immediately went to the Yankees and won the World Series. The young White Sox finished last. Dombrowski asked Chicago GM Roland Hemond if he thought he made a mistake. I remember Roland saying, Dave, it's just different clubs, Dombrowski recalls. When we had the club in 77 over here, we got a club that you could make the lineup out. Let them play. Lem was real good with that. Good with the players. Good communicator. Had a good feeling of pitching. But in 78, we had a young club, and he just wasn't the right manager for the situation. Then he went to the Yankees, who were a veteran club, and he was perfect for them. Hemond also used to say that Boston, New York, and Philadelphia are different from the other major league cities. Once when someone asked why he hadn't gotten the managerial job in Boston, Dombrowski admitted, I think you'd have a hard time dealing with the media here. The candidate eventually got a job elsewhere. The general manager also needs to evaluate himself, says Young. During his first years in Texas, veteran skipper Bruce Bochy was the perfect counterpart for him because Young was still learning on the job. When Bochy retired after last season, Young decided he'd had enough experience to work with someone greener, and he selected Skip Shoemaker, whose years as a Cardinals bench coach and two as Marlins manager still make him nearly a veteran in today's game. It can be hard to find the right fit, says one official, because a lot of front offices don't know what they want. They do a poor job of evaluating their own organization, he continues, and they choose a manager who does not fit the club. At least one team this winter declined to consider a second-time manager because execs thought his hire would not excite fans. That sort of decision-making misses the point. For example, the official says, in a rebuild, I'd hire an incredible communicator because he's going to be communicating to your players on the vision of the organization and the expectation of the organization. You're probably going to have a mediocre team with young prospects coming up at some time. The second thing is he's going to be doing is telling your fan base what you're doing and why you're doing it. Those two skills alone are way more than the grit of, like, that 2-1 hit and run that you called in the seventh inning. After the worst year in Major League history, a 2024 season in which they went 41-121, the White Sox tried to be honest with themselves about what they needed. We wanted somebody that was going to be good for when he was hired, like in a rebuild or whatever you want to call it, and for when we're good, Barfield said. So there were some guys that we interviewed, and they were like, man, this guy would be awesome if we were ready to win right now. But you don't want to have to fire him in 2 years. So how do you find a Brian Snitker before he's Snitker? You run through in-game situations, of course. You ask for strengths and weaknesses. You check references. Some teams ask candidates about their favorite leadership books. They don't expect an encyclopedia knowledge of the genre, but they figure you can't be very serious about the position if you haven't consulted any of the literature. They want to try to predict how the manager will handle pressure, not just the pressure of high-stakes games, but also the pressure of a disappointing season. Young says one of the best pieces of advice he got when embarking on his first managerial search was to hire someone he liked being around. The Guardians process has become legendary throughout the game. For example, Chernoff and the president of baseball operations put Vogt through 28 hours of interviews over the course of 2.5 weeks. They grew so close during that period, Vogt says, that after one call, his wife Alyssa turned to him and said, "You better win this." By then, he was in good shape. 5 minutes into their first Zoom call, Chernoff says he texted Antonetti, "Are you seeing what I'm seeing?" And Antonetti responded, "Yes." The Guardians have compiled a detailed profile describing what they're seeking. Chernoff categorizes it generally as personnel factors, interpersonal factors, and cognitive factors. It's hard to find someone who checks every box, and in fact, they never do. That's why you do crazy interviews, he says, because the other thing they're looking for is someone they can coach. They see a failed manager as not only a failure of hiring on their part, but also a failure of development on their part. And it's a two-way street, Chernoff says. Vogt is developing us too. We are becoming better. Vogt often jokes with Chernoff and Antonetti, "You know so much about me after that interview process that if you don't like my decisions, that's on you." Chernoff agrees. It is. Sometimes the old school background is important. I'm glad I had the journey I did because it allowed me to make some mistakes that weren't on SportsCenter, said Francona, who helmed teams from rookie ball and double A to the Dominican Winter League before working his way up in the majors as a coach. He also values the time he spent with less talented players, which helps him appreciate what he sees now every day. And he needed to fail in his first shot with the Phillies before he could succeed. Sometimes teams bet on the person instead of on the resume. I know I came into the business in a unique manner, says Hinch, who became the Diamondbacks' director of player development a year after retiring as a player and then got his first managerial gig straight from that role. Arizona fired him a year later, and he only found success in his second go-round with the Astros. But that didn't mean the experience didn't matter. It just meant that I was starting behind. He adds the thing that veteran managers have brought to the game are still very valuable, and you can't get them any other way than the way that Botch got it, and Snit, and two-time manager and current Giants infield coach Ron Washington. And sometimes they're just making their best guess. Of the five new guys, first-timers, two or three are probably going to be good, and two or three are probably going to suck, says an official. It's just like the old-timers. The Giants are betting Vitello will fall in the former category. If we're being really honest with ourselves, there's going to be some things that he just can't know until he's here and experience them. But also we talk about being willing to zig when others zag. Tony will bring a very fresh perspective, and he's got a great group around him. I give him a lot of credit for the coaching staff that he's built, including Washington and former Padres manager Jace Tingler. I think hopefully they can all fill in some of the gaps, and that can help him accentuate his strengths. At the annual Cactus League Media Day, the Giants contingent was posted alongside the Brewers. After Vitello took close to an hour's worth of questions, he approached Brewers manager Pat Murphy, perhaps the only person in the league whose background even remotely resembles his own. Murphy, who spent 2 decades at Notre Dame and Arizona State, had been in the majors for 14 years before he was named Brewers manager for 2024. "I was certainly not ready coming out of college," Murphy said. "I needed to be more mature, needed to understand the game at the major league level. Yeah, it's a whole different game." Still, he believes Vitello is ready. At his left, Vitello grinned. "Sir," he said, "can I ask you how the F you coached the pro game?" You're listening to Sports Illustrated on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next article from this Baseball 2026 preview edition, we have, after a hurricane forced them to spend last season in a minor league park, albeit one with hot tubs, the Rays learned that, be it ever so humble, and the trap is so humble, there's no place like Dome, by Emma Bassarelli. Tyler Wahl has spent the better part of 2 decades working for the Rays. His job title is Director of Major League Equipment and Clubhouse Operations. His work is anticipating problems and solving them. Last season, however, Wahl encountered one problem that he thought he would never see with the Rays. A player ran up in the middle of the third inning with an urgent request. "Dude, I've got to get my backup jersey. I'm soaked. I can't even play." And that was the first sign that Wall and his team would have to completely overhaul their laundry routine. They always stocked backup uniforms at the Rays' traditional home, Tropicana Field. They just rarely actually used them, not in their 72 degrees air-conditioned dome in St. Petersburg. But that was going to change for 2025. Temporarily evicted from the Trop after Hurricane Milton severely damaged the stadium when it rolled through Florida in October of 2024, they were playing their home games out in the brutal local heat for the first time. The Rays spent the last season at Steinbrenner Field, the spring training park of the Yankees, across the bay in Tampa. A one-year deal granted the club full-time use of the facility for roughly $15 million. The players, coaching staff, and front office all praised their new home and expressed gratitude for the opportunity to play locally. But even the nicest spring training stadium is not intended for the grind of the regular season. It is also not intended to house major leaguers in the suffocating heat and rolling afternoon thunderstorms of Florida in August. Forget a single backup uniform. One Rays pitcher kept tabs on his personal record. In his sweatiest outing, he went through four jerseys, two pairs of pants, and a second pair of cleats. Wall and his crew had their hands and washing machines full. The experience of playing at a spring facility stretched every member of the organization in one way or another, which means the Rays will have a new perspective when they return to a fixed-up Tropicana Field this season. They have a fresh appreciation for the historically beleaguered field. When the Trop is the topic of conversation, it's usually about what's wrong with it, says Rays President of Baseball Operations Eric Neander, who has been with the club for nearly 20 years. That's changed now. Now it's about everything that's right with it. They all know the quirks and flaws of their idiosyncratic old dome. The organization is still aiming to build a new stadium after nearly two decades of failed deals and thwarted plans. There are new renderings for a Tampa ballpark, the anchor of a large development planned with both public and private funds that would open in 2029. But the Rays are thrilled for now at the chance to return somewhere familiar, somewhere with a roof. There is perhaps no MLB stadium as perpetually tangled in criticism as Tropicana Field. It has been the subject of consternation since it was built. Before the Trop was known as the Trop, when it still carried its maiden name of the Florida Suncoast Dome, it picked up another moniker. Some local media called it the Doom Dome. The city of St. Petersburg began seriously planning for the stadium in 1984. If they built it, a team would surely come, supporters argued. They were anxious to beat out a rival group with its own sights on pro baseball just across the bay in Tampa. There was little enthusiasm from the MLB. Remarks leaked from a committee member on expansion. None other than Yankees owner George Steinbrenner supposedly declared St. Petersburg nothing but a bunch of old folks over there and a rickety bridge to get there. MLB could not exactly demand that a city not build its own stadium, but it could reiterate that it had no immediate desire to bring a franchise to St. Petersburg, and it could remind the city council that there were 12 other markets with potentially compelling expansion cases, including several in Florida. And it could have League Commissioner Pete Ubreroth send a telegram to St. Petersburg Mayor Edward L. Cole Jr. before a key council vote in 1986. Any current decision by St. Petersburg to undertake construction of a facility capable of housing Major League Baseball will be made by your community without any encouragement whatsoever on the part of Major League Baseball, it read. The city broke ground on the stadium that year anyway. Construction finished in 1990. They had built it, and no one came. Or at least no one affiliated with professional baseball. In 1991, MLB awarded its next expansion franchises to Miami and Denver instead of Tampa Bay. Several clubs that flirted with relocating ultimately stayed where they were. The Dome hosted Arena Football, the Storm of the AFL, and Hockey, the Lightning of the NHL, before it saw any baseball. But then came one more round of expansions. With the stadium already waiting and Florida politicians making noise about examining MLB's antitrust exemption when another proposal relocation fell through, the league granted a team to the region, and the stadium got its long-awaited ball club when the Tampa Bay Devil Rays debuted in 1998, which meant the stadium felt somewhat anachronistic even from the day of its very first baseball game. This was fundamentally a ballpark of the 1980s, with its roof and turf. Even among other concrete domes, Tropicana Field was a bit unusual at best and aesthetic at worst. Traffic is a nightmare going in or out. Parking is woeful, and the place itself makes the King Dome look like Wrigley Field, John Feinstein bemoaned in a 1992 column for the New York Times. Baseball was shifting back to neat brick recreations of jewel boxes. Here was an enormous sloping catwalk supported dome that vaguely resembled a circus big top plopped down by the highway. And so the story of the Rays became a story of a team angling to play anywhere but Tropicana Field. A stadium built in search of a team now housed a team in search of a different stadium. The following decades saw failed plans for, among others, a waterfront park in St. Petersburg, a shiny new stadium in Tampa, and one notably strange relocation scheme that would have seen the club splitting time between the Tampa Bay region and Montreal. But while these ideas sputtered, the Rays stayed in the Trop, and like any other ballpark, it became to feel like home for those who played and worked there and became fans there. What outsiders saw as flaws could be charming idiosyncrasies to those viewing them from under the colorful lights of the dome. If other ballparks were newer and nicer, well, many of those ballparks also looked awfully similar to one another. No one ever accused Tropicana Field of lacking a sense of place. It is and has always been clearly a product of Florida. And while the most scorned feature of the stadium was generally its roof, those who loved the park would argue that a closed, air-conditioned environment was valuable enough to be worth compromising on aesthetics. Negative people are all, "Oh, those catwalks are awful. The balls hit them. It's got an ugly roof," says Rays Director of Special Projects and Field Operations Dan Moeller, who has been a groundskeeper for the franchise since its earliest days. "Well, it's a roof. There's nothing better than having a roof over your head." It was the roof that suffered the most damage from Hurricane Milton. The white expanse could look from a distance like great panels of cloth. It was actually Teflon-coated fiberglass woven into a material that could move like fabric. The 100-mile-per-hour winds shredded it and flooded the stadium with debris. To see a place that you've worked for so long turn into sort of a disaster area, it really, really blows your mind how Mother Nature can do that to a building as big as the Trop. Wall said, "You see something that looks like it's indestructible just get crushed by winds and rains, and it's very saddening." With so much damage, there was no conversation about playing there in 2025. The deal for Steinbrenner Field was finalized in scarcely a month. After years of attempting to play in a different stadium, especially one across the bay in Tampa, the club would finally be doing exactly that, but just not how anyone had ever imagined. Countless adjustments were required. There were only 4 days to prepare the park between the Yankees finishing spring training and the Rays hosting opening day. Although Moeller had arranged for several members of his groundkeeping crew to embed the New York team there earlier in the spring, his unit needed a crash course in working an outdoor field. Thousands of pieces of individual signage were hung to cover up New York logos with Tampa Bay ones. Mercifully, there was not much painting, as Yankee Navy Blue is a very similar Pantone shade to Rays Navy Blue. The clubhouse was cleaned out and changed over. Players got used to a park with new dimensions and less foul territory. But the biggest adjustment by far was the weather, and there was little that could be done to prepare for that. Plenty of MLB-headed teams play outdoors in cities that get hot in the summer, but those cities generally do not get Florida hot. The Marlins got themselves under a roof in Miami as soon as they could. MLB had adjusted the schedule to cluster most of the Rays' home games away from the peak of summer, but that still left several home stands in July and August when Mueller's game day temperature readings could reach 120 degrees on the clay, 110 on the grass. And when it wasn't miserably, oppressively hot, it was often raining or threatening to do so. The Rays had their first home rain delay in franchise history on May 10th. The very first big league, high-pressure, regular season tarp pull for the groundskeeping crew, and went on to have 12 more. Some aspects of the situation were pleasant. Many players and employees had shorter commutes due to playing in Tampa instead of St. Petersburg. It was nice to play outside in April and September. There were several features of Steinbrenner Field that were fancier than any at the Trop. Players especially loved the whirlpools. Mueller was glad that his crew got experience with a full season of an outdoor field, and while the Rays' overall record was a disappointing 77-85, they played better at home than on the road, going 41-40 at Steinbrenner Field. Everything was perfectly manageable, but it wasn't theirs. "I've stayed in hotel rooms that are nicer than my house," Neander says, "but home is still home." One of the first people inside Tropicana Field after the hurricane was St. Petersburg Managing Director of City Development Administration, Beth Herendine. She had worked her first job out of college at the stadium back when it was called Thunderdome in the 1990s and serving as the home of the Lightning, and it was unnerving to look up where the roof had always been and see only sky. But she was also struck by just how much had held up. The roof was in tatters, and the field was covered in debris, but the concrete bowl and the concourses were untouched in many places. Herendine passed a Coke bottle standing upright on a table. There was considerable work ahead, but it was all work that she believed they could do. "She may not be the prettiest stadium," Herendine says, "but she is tough." The city was legally obligated to repair the stadium while the lease with the Rays was still in effect. It ultimately cost nearly $60 million. One particular difficulty was keeping water out of the stadium every time it rained. For every 1 inch of storm water that fell from the sky onto that building without a roof, we were collecting 250,000 gallons of water inside of it, said Catherine Karakin, the city's senior capital projects coordinator. Or in the eyes of Mueller, who kept close tabs on the old ballpark, even as he worked every day in their temporary home, the field would look like a lake, he said. It was just, oh my, are we ever going to get to play there again? There was a real anxiety in those early months that perhaps they had played their last game there without knowing it. But a new roof was placed last fall, and upgraded stronger fiberglass fabric and a new field came next. The Rays will be back to Tropicana Field in April. They cannot wait. "We've talked enough about the challenges with playing at Steinbrenner," says Rays manager Kevin Cash. "It was a unique experience for all of us, but there's genuine, authentic excitement to get back to the Trop. They all know that Tropicana Field is not exactly a conventional baseball dream home, but it's their home all the same. It doesn't get a lot of love," Wall says, "but we love it." Our next story is Twin Wins from Track and Field. In January, when Mariah and Mia Maxwell lined up for the girls' 60-meter final at the VA Showcase in Virginia Beach, sisterhood took a back seat. "It's tunnel vision," says Mariah. "I'm not worried about who's next to me or who's behind me." That view is shared by Mia, who won the event in 7.20 seconds, just ahead of her sister. The twins from Humble, Texas, dapped each other up soon after the race ended. They weren't done celebrating. Mariah set the national high school girls' record in the 300-meter at the meet, 36.24. At the Mill Rose Games in February, Mia won the junior 60-meter and triple jump titles, while Mariah finished third in the pro 60-meter field. The Atascosa High seniors won't be apart anytime soon. Both are Texas commits and wouldn't have it any other way. Says Mia, I've depended on her through the hard times, and she's depended on me. As Mariah, track brought us together in ways that I don't think can compare. Our next story is Faces in the Crowd by Dan Falkheim. Gamble Harville, sport, lacrosse, hometown, Boise City, Louisiana. Harville, a sophomore attacker at Centenary College of Louisiana, scored 14 goals in a 21-11 victory over Hendricks College, setting the NCAA All Divisions record for the most goals in a single game. Named the Division III USA Lacrosse Men's Player of the Week for his performance, Harville scored more goals, 39, and points, 45, through his first four games in 2026 than he had in 11 games last year. Maya Johnson, sports softball, hometown Columbia Station, Ohio. Johnson, a redshirt senior pitcher at Belmont, threw a 15-strikeout perfect game in the Bruins' 9-0 season-opening defeat of Missouri State. 2 days later, Johnson tossed 12 strikeouts while only allowing one run in a 2-1 win against number 15 Georgia to lead the program to its first win over a top 25 opponent. A 2025 All-American, Johnson had 24 wins, 366 strikeouts, and a 1.52 ERA last season. Cruz Storer, sport, swimming, hometown, Maui, Hawaii. Cruz, a sophomore at Kamehameha Schools, Maui, won state titles in both the 50-yard, 20.18, and 100-yard, 44.30, freestyle events, setting all Maui records in both races and helping the school win its first state swimming championship. At the Hawaii Senior Championships in November, Cruz set state 15-16 age group records in the 50 free, 100 free, 50 back, and 100 back. In our final stories, going for a spin. When it comes to photographing the Olympics, getting a great frame, like a wide shot of gold medal-winning figure skater Alyssa Liu during her short program, isn't always the hardest part. That would be getting to the venue. Eric W. Rasko covered more than 30 events in his 18 days at the Milan Cortina Games. He spent much of that time negotiating with bus and shuttle drivers. But to even get to the pickup spot in the first place, he had to rely on a temperamental rented Alfa Romeo, which insisted on barking at him in Italian and occasionally engaged its own parking brake in the name of safety. At one point, six guys had to help Rasko push the car out of the road. But he persevered, and the results can be seen at si.com/photos. If the car would check out Rasko's work, it would have had two words, molto bene. Are you using that? There's a long tradition of athletes and secondhand gear, by Mark Betchell. During a casual round of golf earlier this winter, Colin Morikawa borrowed a putter from one of his playing partners, Daniel Kitayama. I said, oh, let me try it, said Morikawa. I tried it on maybe the 13th hole. Felt great. I jokingly said, I might have to take this. He wasn't kidding. Morikawa kept the putter and practiced with it extensively. He used the club at the Phoenix Open and finished 54th. The following week at Pebble Beach, Morikawa used the tailor-made Spider Tour X putter again and won for the first time on tour since October 23rd. It's mine now, Morikawa declared after the win. That was just the latest in a long line of athletes notably borrowing or borrowing someone else's gear and often finding success. For example, Jim Thorpe, prior to the 1500-meter race in the decathlon at the Summer Olympics in Stockholm, Thorpe's shoes were stolen. A teammate loaned him one, where the other one remains a mystery, and he found another in a trash can. The one from the bin was too big, so Thorpe wore extra socks to get a better fit and won the race by nearly 2 seconds to clinch his second gold medal of the games. Bucky Dent. It is a well-worn story. Dent's famous homer against the Red Sox in the AL East playoff was hit with a bat belonging to teammate Mickey Rivers. But there's more to it than that. Rivers had originally borrowed the bat from outfielder Roy White, who was on first when Dent homered. He got there on a single hit using a bat he borrowed from infielder Fred Stanley. Darryl Johnston. After Dallas won Super Bowl XXVIII in Atlanta, the gear belonging to the team's pro bowlers was shipped to Honolulu. One problem, the helmets were pilfered. The Cowboys' fullback improvised, borrowing an extra from Packers quarterback Brett Favre. I had to pump in so much air in Favre's helmet, I thought my head was going to float off, Johnston said, after the NFC's win. Kobe Bryant. Then there's the opposite of borrowing. Late in his career, as the Lakers were in the midst of a 65-loss season, the Black Mamba got fed up with the effort of his team's younger players. After a blowout loss, he sent an equipment man into the locker room with a garbage can to repo the shoes of any player, with the exception of a few veterans wearing Kobe's Nikes. Daniel Camarena. The Padres called up the reliever from the AAA El Paso on July 8th. Since the minors use a DH, he didn't have a bat or batting gloves. So Cato of the Chihuahuas loaned him some gear, which Camarena used to hit a grand slam off Max Scherzer. He then called Cato to ask for another bat. Not because he wanted more, said Cato, because they put that bat in the Padres Hall of Fame. You've been listening to Sports Illustrated on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Sports Highlights by Aje Stellino. Remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. You can also take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.